Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, do you remember your first taste of Thai food? I do, and it was not artisanal. I was 9 or 10 years old, and it was a bag of a Thai brand of instant ramen. And I remember two things about it. One, it was insanely hot for me, and because I was a stupid kid trying to impress his cousins, I kept saying it was fine and kept eating it, even though I was visibly crying. And the other was that the flavors were just not like anything I'd ever had before. It was lemongrassy and kefir lime leafy, and I'd never tasted those things before, and honestly, I really didn't even know if I liked it, but I remember how cool it was to have a chance to taste something totally new. And of course, I love those flavors now, but back then, I didn't know anything about Thai food, and I didn't know anyone who did either. But in the, well, many years since, something incredible happened. In the past 15 years, the Thai population in America has doubled in size, and it's a community that opens a lot of restaurants. In fact, if you're just looking at the ratio to the population, there are 10 times more Thai restaurants than Mexican ones in the United States. And in addition to, you know, all the people who are just like slinging the greatest hits like Pad Thai, there are so many terrific ambassadors and teachers of Thai food in the U.S. People like Mai Pham, Chris Yembenrung, Hong Tai Mi, who you'll meet in a second, James Siaboot, and Andy Ricker. So this week, we want to get a little bit into some of the more popular Thai dishes, some of the ones you may never have heard of, and what they all mean to the people who make them. But first, we'll start with curry. Now, there are hundreds of curries all over Thailand. The most common ones you see in the U.S. are probably based on coconut milk and are probably named after a color. So that color comes from a curry paste, this, you know, flavor bomb of spices and aromatics. And we got a lesson on making a homemade one with the chef Hong Tai Mi. All right, chef.
Hello.
Thanks so much for coming to my house.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You know, I am actually really curious because the curry paste is such a key part of Thai cuisine.
Yes.
Certainly, you can buy lots of them, but you know, many people I know who cook Thai food say many of those are great, but if you want a truly great curry paste, you have to make it yourself.
True.
So I remember the very first Thai cookbook I ever bought. It was called True Thai. And I remember the opening story in the book was that when this chef came to the United States, he had a very small bag. He didn't have a lot of possessions, but he brought his mortar and pestle.
Yeah.
And he sat with it in his seat on the airplane. He said every Thai cook would bring their mortar and pestle with them.
Well, I have brought mine to the kitchen today. So that is so true.
Yeah, so let's make this paste. You have a lot of ingredients with you. Yes. What kind of curry paste are we making today?
We're going to make green curry.
Okay.
And make it super easy because it's like, it could be overwhelming for those who don't know Thai food at all, right?
Sure.
I mean, we talk about cumin seed, we talk about white peppercorn. Some people are like, what is white peppercorn? But if you cannot have white peppercorn, you cannot find it, you can do it with black peppercorn. That's totally okay. And then cumin seeds and then coriander seeds. Okay. That's the dry one.
Okay.
Then we move on to what I call the trinity in Thai cooking, right? Yeah. The lemongrass, galangal, and then kefir lime leaves.
Yeah.
Right? But in Thailand, we would use the rind of the kefir lime itself.
Oh, really?
Yes.
In addition to the leaves?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But here it's harder because of the rules and regulations.
Yeah, you can get the leaves imported, but it's hard to get the fruit. Right?
Correct. And then the garlic, and then some shallots. And, you know, to make it green, of course, you start with the green color pepper. Does that make sense? Yeah, and then when you work with the red curry paste, then you work with the red chili peppers.
Yeah.
But instead of using the fresh one, you use the dry one, but you have to hydrate that.
Soak it in water.
Correct. Yeah. And then never, ever touch it with your bare hands.
Yeah.
Because you never know what's going to happen, right? So in Thailand, we use the root of the cilantro. Mm-hmm. The aroma of it is so much more stronger, and it's going to make you fall in love more with cilantro.
Mm.
So that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
In Thailand, to make it paste together, you put in shrimp paste.
Okay.
But I choose not to put in shrimp paste to bind it together because of food allergy.
Oh, okay.
You know, because we make this at our restaurant and we want to serve everybody.
Yeah.
So we add it on at the end.
Okay.
Should we get started?
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to toast all the dry ingredients.
Okay. So the dry spices go into a warm pan.
Yeah.
Oh, you toast them together. You have to do it separately.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. Dry toast is super easy. You know, medium heat. Toast it.
That smells so great. You can totally smell that cumin.
Oh, I find that cumin makes... green curry, so much better, right? I'm taking all the toasted cumin, the pepper, and then cilantro seed into a mortar.
Okay.
And then you used your strong hand to hold the pestle.
Yeah.
And then use your other hand to use it as a guard.
Yeah. Oh man, you can totally smell that white pepper. I have to admit, so I tell people this all the time, when you're using spices, buy them whole, toast them, grind them fresh. I always do it in a spice grinder, and I don't get this aroma like you would get in the mortar and pestle. Like, it smells incredible.
10 times more. Now, chili, do you like it spicy?
Sure.
You know, Thai cooking is about to your taste. Do you like it spicy? You put more. You don't like it spicy? You put less.
Yeah, no big deal.
No big deal.
You'll throw
wanna try?
Sure.
I want to see what kind of cook are you. All right, hold.
No pressure.
Yep, okay. Found it.
So I'm right-handed, so I hold the pestle in my right hand.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Left hand goes over the hole of the mortar to kind of keep things in. And you just kind of...
And you sound like you're in a Thai kitchen right now. Seriously, if you close your eyes right now, this is the sound of Thai kitchen. This is the sound that my grandma would do.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to start putting it more ingredients.
Okay.
Lemongrass in there.
Boop. So things do fly out of the mortar for sure.
It's fine.
Like, this is definitely not going to be a situation where you're not going to use a vacuum afterwards.
Nope. The coffee lime's there.
Oh, wow.
Woo. Right?
I just got a big chunk of that lemongrass and it just, you could just feel it bloom. Pounding. At what point do you start grinding?
At the same time.
Okay.
Because you know you want to mix it.
Okay.
I'm going to start chopping more ingredients, okay?
Sure.
The lango, another name is blue ginger.
Mmm. Some garlic cloves.
Mm-hmm. To give the body. And then I'm going to chop up some shallots.
I'm not going to lie, this is pretty tiring.
It is! It is. That's why you have to breathe in. Oxygen would help you. It's a stress releaser.
Okay, so now some shallots, just big diced shallots.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting because green curry in Thai is called gang kiao wan. Gang means curry, kiao means green, wan means sweet. Mm. So it's a curry that is green and it's sweet. Sweet from coconut milk and palm sugar.
Mmm, okay.
So have that round sweetness into it.
Yeah.
And then you can make a spicy part to be add-on. And that is the myth about Thai food. People think it's always spicy. It doesn't have to be always spicy.
Well, that also varies region by region too, right?
True. Southern eats more spicy. Depends, you know.
So now the paste, we've been pounding for a while, but it doesn't look like the deep army green curry paste you get out of a can. It looks much fresher, much greener, much wetter.
Mm-hmm. So what, after 15 minutes or so? And now all you have to do is pick your own protein, and that you make the dish. So after you pound all this, you can have a meal in half an hour.
Yeah,
you
just simmer it until done, and then you're good. Mm-hmm. So should we try making the paste again, but in a blender this time? And we're going to have a little side-by-side.
Okay.
Now, when you make this in a blender, do you put everything in order, or you just throw it all in?
I throw it all in and hit go.
Okay.
I always tell my friends to put in some liquid to help the machine.
Okay.
And the best liquid to put this in is a coconut milk, because we're going to cook that in the coconut milk anyway.
Sure.
So everything's in there.
Okay, so just a few splashes of coconut milk into the blender to help it move along when you blend it.
Mm-hmm.
And...
go.
Beautiful sound. Okay. Well, that was a lot quicker. I'm not going to lie. It still smells really good, but it does not smell the same.
Right? Shallots and garlic.
Yeah. You smell so much shallot and garlic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so much less of the basil, the cilantro, the spices, yeah, the herbs. All right, should we just cook these really quick and taste them?
Oh, we have to. Yes.
Okay, so we just have two pans on the stove, one with the pounded curry paste and one with the blender curry paste, and we just kind of let them bubble a little bit and wait for the color to change. Just a couple of tablespoons of coconut milk in each pan and a couple of tablespoons of the curry paste. Not quite one-to-one, a little more paste to milk.
So I'm stirring the blended one.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go ahead and keep on working on your homemade one.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
See, can you tell the color is intensifying?
Yeah.
And the smell right now?
It smells really, really good.
So this is a process that I love.
Because,
I mean, seriously, it's like all the aromatic and all the colors start to change. Yeah. And this is the time where you put in the protein.
Okay. So you're not looking for it to really fry or really reduce. You get that moisture out of there.
Mm-hmm.
The color changes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It deepens.
Yeah.
And then you're ready to add the rest of your coconut milk to make the curry.
And then we're going to season with the palm sugar.
Now, if you don't have palm sugar...
Brown sugar. Or maple syrup, believe it or not.
Oh, right on.
How does that look?
It looks beautiful. So this is... I love the pounded paste because it's still a little chunky.
Mm-hmm.
But cooking down the coconut milk, it's, you know, it looks glossy, it looks smooth. A little bit of fish sauce for salt and aroma. And you're good? We're done here?
Yeah, let's taste it.
All right. So basically, it's the consistency right now of like a, you know, like a light cream soup or like a light cream sauce.
Yeah. So should we taste the homemade one first?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Wow. The flavors have all come together.
Mm.
And this is the blended one. It's definitely tasty, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be really happy to eat that.
But this one is more well-rounded, meaning the homemade one.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. More harmonious.
Yeah, in a funny way, because you'd expect the blender to make it more harmonious, but the pounding really like sort of brings all the oils together.
Yep. The flavor is more deepened.
All right, well, this has been totally educational, and I'm convinced I need to pound my curry paste until my arm falls off now.
Oh, no.
Well, I got to work out.
You got to work out.
I'm convinced I need to work out.
It's my pleasure being here. Thank you so much for having me.
This is awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Hong Tai-mi is the chef of Tai-mi Table in New York and the author of True Thai, Real Flavors for Every Table. You can find her recipe for green curry paste at splendidtable.org, so you can get pounding, and I promise you, you can probably skip the gym that day. Coming up next, we get into some of the regional flavors of Thailand with Austin Bush and Leela Bunyaratnapong. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. So, for a lot of fans of Thai food, it's, you know, hard to imagine a world without coconut milk. But there are whole regions within Thailand that barely ever touch the stuff, where, you know, some of the key flavors are things like numbing Sichuan peppercorn-like spices, and where curry paste might be as simple as garlic, shallots, and chilies pounded together. And I learned a lot about the people and the cuisines of these regions when I edited a book called The Food of Northern Thailand by Austin Bush. Austin's lived in Thailand for 20 years, and he went into restaurants, roadside stands, libraries, and people's homes to collect the recipes for his book. And he's here to talk about it. Austin, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we worked on this book together for like 2 years minimum. Like, I don't even remember how long it's been since you started. But, you know, something I've realized I don't actually know about you is how you got into Thai food in the first place.
It was kind of a coincidence. To be honest, initially I was more interested in language. I was studying Thai at the University of Oregon. Got a scholarship to study Thai at Chiang Mai University in northern Thailand.
Okay.
And to be honest, like, I found Thai food kind of weird. Like, I hadn't really eaten it before. Everything was new to me. And so, you know, I was intrigued by that. But at the same time, it was a really good way for me to use my Thai to order food, to ask people about things. And Thai people are crazy about food.
Yeah.
Very happy to talk about it. So it was kind of the easiest way for me to, like, improve my language skills.
So, like, 20 years later, you've lived in Thailand for 20 years. Mm-hmm. You've traveled through many parts of the country, but especially in northern Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've been to big cities, you've been to really small communities. What are some of the reactions that you get from people who presumably don't see a lot of tourists when this white dude starts showing up and asking them how to cook their food in Thai?
You know, Thai people are very proud of their food. And when someone who's taken the opportunity to learn a bit about the food and especially the language, they're very impressed.
Mm.
People love it. And food is such a sort of elemental, basic, fun, easy, accessible thing to talk about. Nowadays in Bangkok, I feel like there's a lot of foreigners who speak Thai, so I don't really stand out so much.
Mm-hmm.
But when I go to these villages in northern Thailand, yeah, people are very excited. They're very impressed, especially that someone is interested in their culture, interested in their food, interested in their language. Like, it didn't take very much work for me to be allowed into people's homes, into their professional kitchens, into, you know, hawker stalls. And I often didn't even have to ask twice.
So let's talk about northern Thai food. I think when most people think of Thai food, here in the United States anyway, we think of certain flavors. We'll think of chilies, we'll think of lime, we'll think of fish sauce, we'll think of coconut milk and those kinds of, you know, curries, like yellow curry, green curry, yada,
sure.
yada. But in the north, these are not necessarily the key flavors, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the most sort of outstanding characteristics of northern Thai food is it's not that spicy. Northern Thai food doesn't have a whole lot of chilies. What it does have is a lot of umami. People love savory flavors. And so MSG is in everything. they like bitter flavors. And that can come from herbs. That can come from more challenging ingredients like gallbladder or the liquid inside the gallbladder, bile, things like that. Or even there's meat dishes that are seasoned with undigested sort of grass and bile. And there's a bit more use of dried spice in northern Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, there's one dried spice called makwen, and it's kind of related to Sichuan pepper. I think it's called prickly ash in English, and it has kind of a numbing, almost like evergreen sort of flavor, a little bit spicy, and, you know, it gives you that sort of pleasantly kind of numbing sensation.
Yeah.
And it's added to meat dishes.
But there are a lot of dishes of northern Thai food. And, I, you know, certainly I'm not a student of it. I've never been there. But I've eaten it here in restaurants like Andy Ricker's restaurant, Pok Pok. He serves a lot of northern Thai dishes. And there's a lot of, certainly the food he serves, that is very clearly delicious to someone who's not familiar with that palate. So tell me about some of the aspects of the cuisine that, you know, someone who's new to it might immediately be drawn to.
Yeah, there's one Northern Thai dish that I feel like every foreign visitor to Thailand just falls in love with immediately. And it's a curry noodle soup called khao sai. And you have this kind of mild coconut milk curry broth with chicken or beef and noodles. And oddly enough, they're not elements you see in too many other Northern Thai dishes. They're kind of just in this one dish. Mm-hmm. But it's so accessible and so delicious and so kind of easy that everybody loves it.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, because the cuisine isn't super spicy, a lot of the dishes are kind of accessible. There's a lot of soups that are, you know, kind of savory, a little bit salty. The dishes aren't sweet at all. Mm. There's a lot of meat dishes. I found that interesting in particular because going around Northern Thailand, talking to old people in particular, especially in remote places, I learned that meat was really scarce for these people when they were growing up. If you talk to someone who's 60 years old or whatever, several people told me that they would only get meat once a year for some sort of Buddhist ceremony or ordination or something like that. And a buffalo would be slaughtered or a pig would be slaughtered. But nowadays, some of the dishes we associate most with Northern Thai cooking are meaty. Mm-hmm. Grilled pork, sour fermented pork, and lap, this kind of salad of minced meat. Northern style lap has some dried spice in it. This dried spice is called mekwen that I was talking about earlier. There's a little bit of chili, but not much. And often it's eaten raw. So this is the dish where you get things like blood added to it or bile or you know, liquid from the gallbladder to give it a sort of bitter taste, which Northern Thais really love.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a really like minerally intense tartar kind of vibe.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's one more seasoning that I was really struck by. I still can't quite picture, but I love this image you have in the book of driving through the region called Mae Hong Son. I probably pronounced that terribly. But everywhere you go there, you said you would smell of these toasted soybean cakes. And that's both a food and a seasoning. It kind of has this sort of like interesting, unique role there.
Yeah, so in Mae Hong Son, sort of the northwestern corner of Thailand, the people are predominantly Shan, which is an ethnic group kind of related to the Thais. And they really love this ingredient called Thua Nao, which literally means rotten beans. And what they what they do is they take soybeans, you boil them, you mash it up into a really thick paste, and then you let it ferment. And then they're pressed into these discs that are dried in the sun. So they can be kept for months and months. And I think in the old days, people would grill those and crumble them over rice. And I think that's pretty much what a meal was, maybe 80, 90 years ago or whatever. Mm. These days, you still find it a lot, but it's kind of more of a seasoning. You'd grind it up with chili and make it into sort of a dip. Or it's similar to the way that shrimp paste is used in Central Thai cooking. So you'd pound it up with different herbs and spices and stuff like that in a paste. There's some that are seasoned, so they'll add a bit of lemongrass and chili and probably salt. And those are the kind that are meant to be sort of grilled and then crumbled over rice. But I think the standard one is...
That sounds so good.
I don't think it's salted. It's just plain. People toast them before they use them. And it's such a distinctive smell. It smells like sort of toasty, and it makes me think of that province every time I smell it. And if you drive around in Mae Hong Son in the evening or in the morning, you'll definitely smell it. It's still a very fundamental part of people's cuisine there.
Yeah. So you brought the Shan people, and they are an ethnic group that you said are related to the Thai. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, ignorant me, I'm like, oh, Thailand, it's full of Thai people. And yes, they are all Thai and that they are all in Thailand, but there are many, many people who ethnically do not identify as Thai. They're of these different ethnicities, different tribes, different groups. And you write a lot about these different groups through the regions of Northern Thailand. Tell me a little bit about them and how that's created this unique cuisine of all these different influences.
Sure. Yeah, Northern Thailand is pretty multicultural. Most people think of the hill tribes, which are different groups that came to Thailand, Northern Thailand, about 100 years ago, kind of settling in these like mountainous areas. And not much has been written about their food, but I have a hill tribe buddy, and he took me to his village. He's Akha. His family grows coffee in Chiang Rai province, and I stayed with him and his mom for a couple of days, and his mom makes amazing food. Mm. And sort of paradoxically, there's some of the simplest recipes in the book.
Yeah,
you know, traditionally these people didn't have a lot of access to fancy ingredients and stuff. So there's a dish that's like small cherry tomatoes grilled over coals and then mashed up with garlic and garlic chives and stuff like that as a dip. And it's like salsa. It's totally
as a dip for sticky rice.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds so good.
His mom made this other dish that's so good, and it's kind of like meatloaf, I guess. It's kind of like lap, and then it's fatty pork minced up with a bunch of herbs, including garlic chives. And then you wrap it in banana leaves and grill it, and it comes out like this spicy herbal meatloaf.
Oh, cool.
It's really amazing. And then there's other groups. There's groups that are more closely related to the Thai people that speak Thai-related languages, like the Shan, or there's a group called the Thai Lu. And I was able to spend a little bit of time in some Thai Lu villages and get their recipes as well. And then there's a relatively big Chinese population in northern Thailand, some of whom are Muslims who used to run these trading routes across mainland Southeast Asia from Myanmar and China to the coast, where they would bring things from China, get salt, and then come bring that salt back to China. Uh-huh. So you find these little enclaves in northern Thailand of Chinese people, Chinese Muslims, and then sort of more recently, after China was taken over by the communists in 1949, a lot of people fled across the borders. They were sort of like resistance fighters, the KMT fighters, who held out in these little villages in northern Thailand, and they still speak Yunnanese dialects. They still, you know, eat very Chinese dishes. I thought that was really fascinating. So yeah. I included some of those recipes as well.
Yeah. It's amazing how, you know, we so often think of the world as being nations, countries, these political boundaries, but the ethnic groups ebb and flow from one country to the other, like, with so much fluidity. It's like you travel and talk to people and find their stories and find their heritages, and like everywhere you go in the world is way more complicated and complex than it might seem just by looking at a map. This is awesome, Austin, and it's been a pleasure talking with you. It was a real pleasure working with you on the book, and hope you come back to the U.S. again soon.
Thanks for having me, Francis.
Austin Bush is the author of The Food of Northern Thailand. He's also the photographer for Pok Pok and other books by the chef Andy Ricker. Austin left us a recipe, one of those noodle dishes he talked about from the Shan people. It's called Khao Sen, Shan-style noodle soup with pork and tomato, and it's at splendidtable.org. After hearing about the rustic, you know, mostly country-style food of northern Thailand, we also wanted to get into some of the city food of central Thailand. And so the obvious place to look is in Bangkok. It is a city of 15 million people. And if you look at the pictures, it's, you know, all gleaming skyscrapers and golden, gorgeous royal temples. But Leela Bunyaratapan has a closer perspective. She grew up there in a house built by her great-grandparents. And she writes about the history of Thai cuisine, from regular home food to dishes created for royalty, in her books Simple Thai Food and her latest, Bangkok. Hey, Leela, great to talk with you.
Great talking to you too, Francis.
Okay, here's something I really want to start with, because I have been told, I feel like 1,000 times, that, well, you know, the food that most Americans think of as Thai food is really central Thai food, you know, which is where Bangkok is. And I've heard it so many times, I just assume it's true, but I don't really know what it means. What does that mean?
Yeah, I've heard that many times too, and I don't know what it means either. Seems a little too simplistic,
sure.
And a lot of assumptions go into that, I think. But it's kind of complicated. I agree that most of the dishes that you find on the menus of most Thai restaurants outside Thailand are based on the dishes that you would find in urban areas of Thailand, including Bangkok.
Okay. So those dishes like Pad Thai, Pad Siew.
Exactly. Yes.
But you write in your book that Bangkok, even though it's in the heart of central Thailand, its food is sort of its own thing.
Yes. Central Thailand is a broad, flat, alluvial plain with many rivers, including the Dao Phraya River. And the region also touches the ocean, the Gulf of Thailand. So we're talking about an extremely fertile area, the land of rice and fish, you know.
Yeah.
And the central Thai cuisine relies heavily on marine lives and the vegetation that grows in river basins. But what makes the food of Bangkok different from the food of central Thailand in general? This is where the secondary elements come into play. Mm. And these are the cultural elements. Bangkok has always been the center of government, diplomacy, and trade. You know, how old is the city? 236 years? Yeah. Yeah, 236 years. In April, yes. So out of the traditional Central Thai cuisine, we see a new cuisine emerge. And it's a result of a confluence of many cultures and belief systems, migrations, settlements, those kinds of things. And you don't see this in other regions of Thailand, at least not on this scale. You see Persian influences, Indian influences, very strong Chinese influences as well, and some Portuguese influences, some British, and later on some American influences, etc.
What are some of the Persian influences? I've never heard that.
Well, have you heard of matzoman curry?
Yeah.
That is Persian.
Oh, matzoman. Like Muslim, like what people used to call Muslims.
Exactly.
No kidding. So that matzoman curry is yellow, if we're going with like the color guide, because again, you look at that stereotypical menu.
The traffic light curries, you mean?
Yeah, but it's like yellowy orange-ish, right? But what distinguishes matzoman curry in terms of its technique or its ingredients from the other curries?
I would say the presence of dry spices, which you don't see a lot in the other colored curries. Like, for example, the use of dry spices like cinnamon and cloves, star anise, some other dry spices that you don't see in red curry or green curry or other curries.
Yeah.
And another thing is that if you notice, matzoman curry isn't as spicy hot as green curry or red curry. And that is one of the characteristics of Persian or South Indian influences in Thai cuisine as well.
Like less chili and more dry spice. So interesting. So in the book, you also write about the house that your great-grandparents built in Bangkok in the 40s. And you describe their kitchen so beautifully. I'd love to hear you tell us about that kitchen, what cooking in that kitchen was like.
This is not a typical Bangkok kitchen.
Okay.
I grew up in a pretty weird home, in a good way. In retrospect, I didn't see it as being good at that point. But it's a very traditional family, and my great-grandparents were born at the very end of the 1800s. My great-grandfather served as a civil servant in the royal court. And his generation was the last generation that lived through, worked through, and retired in the times of the absolute monarchy system, against the backdrop of the social hierarchy of that age. So he was very set in the way he wanted to live and eat. I'll never understand it fully, but his house, which is the house that my parents, my aunts, and my uncles, and my cousins lived in or around, was set up in such a way that it never really moved on from the 1800s. It was stuck in that era, happily so.
Yeah.
We had electricity and we used it for other purposes, but for some reason in the kitchen, though, not so much.
Okay.
We had a large built-in clay and brick stove with two burners. It comes up to your waist. So all the food shopping would be done in the morning. We would buy just enough for the day, no freezing, no storing anything other than the pantry items like shrimp paste, garlic, stuff like that. Most of the cooking would be done in the morning, too. The burners would be on throughout the morning, mostly to cook things that need to be cooked for a long time. And then for quick last-minute cooking, we have a few small clay stoves for that. It's like a museum, Francis.
Yeah. It was all like wood and coal-fired. There's a detail that I thought was so striking. And you talk about they would have a pot outside the window for catching water that you then scent with flowers.
Yeah.
And
there's a huge clay jar that is reserved for that purpose, to collect rainwater.
And that water would go into a dish that I'd never heard of, but sounds incredible. It's rice in ice-cold flower-scented water with all these different accompaniments, like shrimp dumplings and preserved radishes and stuffed peppers.
It's a very sophisticated, complicated dish. You would polish the rice until the grains are clean. You want to wash off all of the starchiness so that the water would remain clear, like crystal clear, throughout the entire meal.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you picked this dish to talk about, because I can't think of a better dish that would exemplify what we've talked about, you know, in terms of what makes the cuisine of Bangkok unique. This dish originally comes from the Mon, an ethnic group who migrated in several waves from Myanmar or Burma and have assimilated into the Thai culture. And the original Mon version is very, very simple. Mm. The version you see in Bangkok today, though, is very sophisticated, very elaborate. And we have the ladies of the royal court in the early days of Bangkok to thank for this. Mm. They were of Mon descent, and they were the ones who took this dish and reinterpreted it through the lenses of the royal cuisine. And that's how we got the current version, which is served mostly during the Thai New Year celebration in April. Uh-huh. It's really hot in April, so this comes in handy. It takes a village to put it together. It's definitely not a weeknight meal.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the things that go. So you have this rice, which you've cooked and then cleaned. Right. You mm-hmm. submerge it in ice-cold, flower-scented water, which sounds just incredible.
Which you had to prepare the night before.
To infuse the flavor.
Right.
And then there are all these things that go with it. Tell us about what those things are.
Well, those things vary, but certain things remain the same, regardless of who the cook is. The shrimp paste dumplings, the stuffed shallots, those are always present. The sweet radish, the preserved radish, that's mm-hmm. always there too. And a stuffed pepper that is wrapped in strands of egg. You have to make it by hand.
Oh, wow.
It's really something. It's a celebration. It's you don't want to do this every day.
Yeah. And the dish is called, how do you pronounce the dish in Thai?
Khao Cha.
Khao Cha. Okay, so mm-hmm. I am going to plan to go to Thailand in April to go get some Khao Cha during the Thai New Year.
That sounds like a plan.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Leela.
Thank you, Francis.
Leela Bunyaratnapan is the author of the cookbooks Bangkok and Simple Thai Food, and she also blogs at shesimmers.com. And she left us with a serious party recipe for 16 people. It's called 24-Hour Chicken Masaman Curry, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. And coming up, we find out why there are so many Thai restaurants in America. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So at the top of the show, I mentioned that there are just an incredible number of Thai restaurants in the U.S., you know, relative to how many Thai people there actually are here. And the reason for that is fascinating. Mark Padungpot, a professor of Asian and Asian American Studies, is here to help us understand why. Hey, Mark, it's great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Francis.
I'm excited to talk with you. So I was talking with a friend once, and we were talking about the kind of cookie cutter-ish menu that, you know, lots of Thai restaurants have, you know, and he said, well, you know why they're all pretty much the same, right? I'm like, no, why? And he said, well, the Thai government trains people on how to open those restaurants and then sends them out into the world. And I was like, whoa, what? Is that true? Is that why there are so many Thai restaurants in the United States?
You know, yeah, I've read a couple of those stories too, and that's absolutely true. And, you know, the Thai government has been invested in this to really promote Thai cuisine, and you know, it's part of their economic national development plan that was started around the early 2000s. And, you know, they train chefs, they export them to, like, everywhere around the world to open restaurants and to work in restaurants. And, you know, it's to stimulate tourism to Thailand, but it's also to try to standardize Thai taste around the world, because the government also feels like the different kinds of Thai food around the world has given it somewhat of a bad name. And so they're trying to standardize this Thai flavor.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, it's so funny because then you have people who always say, well, you know, the stuff you get there is nothing like what you get here. But that's sort of immaterial, right? Because, like, oh, what they're trying to do is almost establish, like, a global baseline that, you know, may not have anything to do with what it seems Thai people actually eat in Thailand.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I've heard some rumors of the government creating or they have this taste robot to to actually taste Thai, you know, dishes. And, you know, I guess in some formula that the robot has determines whether or not this is authentic Thai flavors or not.
Oh my God,
yeah,
that's so
crazy. That's also fascinating too.
But okay, but in your book, in your history, you know, Thai restaurants in the United States are not here because the government has been sending them. Like you said, this has been since the early 2000s, so like 15 years or so. And in your history, Thai food in America really starts in Los Angeles. How did it become popular there?
Yeah, and so I'll add that too, right? So reading a lot of these stories about the Thai government's role is really important because I think it challenges that idea that, you know, Thai immigrants just pick up and go and open up restaurants on their own. And I think it's important to think about the role that governments have. But when I read the stories, I'm always like, that only explains the number of Thai restaurants since the early 2000s. And so my book actually really traces it to the 1980s. And as you said, Los Angeles is the kind of crucible of the Thai food scene in the United States. And there's really three key turning points here. One is that it starts not when Thai immigrants come to LA, but when the United States goes to Thailand during the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s. And by the United States, I mean the U.S. military, Peace Corps volunteers, Fulbright fellows. And so those U.S. citizens come into contact with Thai food, write Thai cookbooks, introduce it to suburban housewives back in West L.A., and that kind of gets the ball rolling. And then, you know, within a decade or two, you have a huge migration of Thai students coming to study in the Los Angeles area and really around the country. And they are the first ones to open Thai restaurants to feed themselves, to feed other students. And then, you know, they feel like, hey, let's try to sell some of this food to Angelenos. And then the other kind of big turning point is the opening of the Bangkok market in 1971. So before the opening of the market, Thai people are cooking, quote unquote, Thai food, but they're really using Chinese ingredients and they're substituting ingredients. And so they can't, they don't have...
Who might find at a Chinese market?
Exactly. So, you know, they have soy sauce, but they don't have fish sauce. They don't have any kaffir lime leaves. And so the Bangkok market opened by Pramot Tilakamongkorn, he is the first to import Thai canned goods, Thai produce, Southeast Asian produce. They try to grow it in California. Ultimately, they end up in Mexico growing, you know, 90% of the Southeast Asian produce that comes into the United States. And so those, I think, three moments really give rise to the Thai food scene in LA in the 1960s, in the late 1960s.
And then how did it spread across the country?
Yeah. If we look at where Thai people are settling in the 1970s, they're in California, but then they're also in Illinois, Michigan, Texas, D.C., and that's because they're studying there. And those students then open up Thai restaurants. Again, they create a market for Thai cuisine in these other areas. So I think that's part of the story. And then you also have, again, in the 1970s, partly because of the Bangkok market family, you have this conglomerate of Thai people who then start to recruit other Thais to open up restaurants in other places. And I think the other factor here in terms of visibility as well is Tommy Tang, who was a really popular Thai chef in Los Angeles, who cooked kind of this, what we might call fusion Thai food today. But he opens up a restaurant in New York in the 1980s and becomes the first bi-coastal Thai chef in the United States. And I think that helps expand it nationally too.
Yeah. You know, this thing about LA... So Thai Town is a little east of Hollywood, but some of the restaurants you mentioned in the book that are really sort of key in Los Angeles are in West Hollywood.
Yes.
The restaurant Talasai, which is owned by my friend Chris Yenbarung. You know, he comes from that restaurant family, and, and I remember hearing him talk about how, you know, David Geffen used to come in as a regular for lunch, and, you know, he would bring... you know, whatever pop star was on his record label at the time. And so they would have these mega stars at their restaurants. And I think, well, in the 80s, it's LA, it's celebrity culture. Like, everyone starts to really care about where Madonna has, what Madonna wears, what Madonna does in her spare time, what Madonna eats. So...
yeah, that's an important cultural phenomenon that I think gets overlooked a lot. How does it become, you know, what I would consider, like, it's Thai food is seen as trendy. It has a certain cultural cachet, but how did that develop? And I think to explain that, you have to look at LA in the 1980s and you have to look at what's happening locally, specifically within West Hollywood. And so a lot of the early Thai restaurants that open in West Hollywood. As you mentioned, Thalesai is on the Sunset Strip. Chandala is right in the heart of Hollywood. And you have Royal Thai Cuisine, which is also near movie studios. And these restaurants highlight just how many celebrities come in. So Victor Sotsuk, who ran the Siamese Princess in West Hollywood, you know, he wrote a cookbook and he's like, Madonna comes to my restaurant. Oh, this is the 1980s, of course. He's like, Madonna comes in. She has her own booth. Prince comes in all the time. At Thalesai, Prakat Yembamrum is like, you know, Harrison Ford eats here often. And I think that in order to explain how it is that Thai food becomes popular, I think you have to talk about the rise of celebrity culture and LA in the 80s, right? There's a certain aesthetic, but that connection to celebrity culture, Hollywood, the music industry, the movie industry, I think gives Thai food a certain cultural cachet that I think is part of that story of the popularization.
Yeah, it had a vibe. It wasn't just like, oh, check out, you can get it. It's a vibe. It's cool. This is so interesting. Thanks so much, Mark.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on, Francis.
Mark Padungpot is author of Flavors of Empire, Food and the Making of Thai America, and he's an associate professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So earlier in the show, if you heard the chef Hong Tai Mi hand pound her curry paste, you might start to think that the coconut milk you use for curry better do right by all the sweat that goes into making that paste. Well, the brand she likes is called Chef's Choice, and you probably need to get it in an Asian market, but our friends at America's Test Kitchen did a taste test of coconut milks you can get in all kinds of places. Sally Swift got the report from Jack Bishop.
Hey, Jack, great to have you back.
Nice to be back, Sally.
So we have spent this hour talking about Thai food and got me thinking about an ingredient that we use a lot in cooking Thai, which is coconut milk. Have you guys ever evaluated it?
Of course we've evaluated it, Sally. We evaluate everything. We've actually tested 7 different brands. I bet you didn't know there were 7 brands of full fat.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and that's just the full fat canned coconut milk. And we really do think the full fat brands are better than the low fat for the obvious reason that fat makes things delicious.
That's right, it does. And can you just, I actually don't even know how it's made. How is coconut milk made?
Yeah, it's kind of confusing. A lot of people end up sometimes buying the wrong thing. So the liquid that comes out of the center of the coconut, that's coconut water. That's the sports drink that's also popular. You don't really cook with that. Coconut milk is they take shredded, unsweetened coconut, mix it with water, and basically strain out the water, and that liquid is now called coconut milk. And that is the thing that we cook with. It is unsweetened, so would be different than the thing in our beverages. That would be cream of coconut, which has got, you know, it's extra thick and it's got sugar in it. And you certainly don't want to be using cream of coconut in a savory dish. You really want to get unsweetened coconut milk.
I have noticed that there are amazing differences between brands and the way they look. Did you guys notice that? I mean, some of them have liquid on the top. Some of them are gray. Some of them, you can see the fat on the top. Do you have that experience?
Yeah, they were all over the place. Some of them, as you say, were gray, which isn't terribly appealing. Mm-hmm. They should have the fat separated out on the top. And we actually measured the amount of fat in each can versus the liquid. And some of them were 50-50. And some of them were very close to almost all liquid. And some of them were almost all fat and really ranged quite considerably. Huh. We found an expert at a university in Thailand who said it's the variety and the age of the coconuts that's probably explaining that, as well as how much coconut they're putting to how much water. And that obviously if they add a lot of coconut to a small amount of water, you're going to get a much higher fat, more viscous coconut milk, as opposed to if they're using a lot of water and not very much coconut.
Well, that is interesting, and it's interesting that it's allowed to be so erratic. It's not regulated, right?
There are no regulations in the U.S. about this, and so the brands that we tested, there were 7 different brands, mostly from Thailand or from Vietnam, and I would say 4 of them were similar and recommended, but several of them really felt like they were going to make either a broken or slightly greasy soup, for instance. We made Thai coconut soup with chicken in it as one of the recipes, and really found that it did impact the quality of the finished dish depending on the brand of coconut milk you were using.
It's interesting. Okay, so what was the winner?
So the winner was a brand from Thailand.
Yay.
It's called Aroy D. So A-R-O-Y, a little dash, and then the letter D. Mm-hmm. It was high in fat, also high in sugars. These are the natural sugars from the coconut, which is an indication that they were actually using a fair amount of coconut and a modest amount of water.
Hmm. And what about the big loser, just to get to the other end?
Well, there was one brand that we really did not like. It was watery and separated. It's called A Taste of Thai Coconut Milk. And we just felt like it didn't have any coconut flavor. And in the various tests was underwhelming.
And do you have a runner-up to the ROD if you can't get that one?
So our runner-up is a brand called Roland, R-O-L-A-N-D. This one is from Vietnam, and another brand that we liked quite a lot.
And what about Goya? How did Goya do? Because you can find that almost everywhere.
So Goya was in third place. Goya actually comes from the Dominican Republic. I think it was the only one in the mm-hmm. lineup that didn't come from Asia, and was recommended and finished in third place.
Okay. Thanks for coming in, Jack.
Thank you, Sally.
Jack Bishop is the Chief Creative Officer of America's Test Kitchen, and you can find their coconut milk rankings at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. We hope your new year's off to a great start, and until next time, eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you for your generosity. We can't do it without you, and we love doing what we do. To help support our show, just head to splendidtable.org and be sure to subscribe to our podcast wherever you get yours. And if you like it, please leave us a review. It really helps. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our assistant producer. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. Talk to you next week. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.